Welcome to another edition of the Progressive Forum. The Progressive Forum covers issues such as human rights, the environment, politics, and peace and justice, in addition to presenting news, commentary, and a weekly calendar of events.
This is KPFT, 90.1 Pacifica Radio in Houston. I'm Wally James. The show is The Progressive Forum. And our first guest tonight is William Hartung. He's the director of the Arms and Security Project. And his latest article is The Hidden Cost of National Security. 10 Ways Your Tax Dollars Pay for War, Past, Present, and Future. And coming up after that, our next interview is going to be with Zachary Neely, and he's an 18-year-old graduate of Straight Jesuit College Preparatory. And he wrote a powerful op-ed published in the Houston Chronicle on July 8th titled, U.S. Conflicts Don't Stay Abroad, They Hit Home. And then at 8 o'clock, we're going to have a talk by Anthony DiMaggio, and it's titled Capitalism. Does Capitalism Have a Future? And so stick around for all that. We're going to start things off with This Week in History. On July 28, 1868, the 14th Amendment is ratified, guaranteeing due process to everyone except Native Americans. On July 24, 1925, John T. Scopes is convicted in Tennessee of teaching the theory of evolution. On July 27, 1932, Washington, D.C., two men are killed when U.S. soldiers attack an encampment of World War I veterans who are demanding their bonus benefits. On July 23, 1967, a week of racial unrest begins in Detroit and leaves 43 people dead. On July 26, 1970, a workers' strike at Dow Chemical Plant at Rocky Flats, Colorado, over the unsafe handling of radioactive materials. On July 29, 1970, grape growers sign a contract with United Farm Workers, ending the grape boycott. And on July 27, 1974, the House Judiciary Committee votes for the impeachment of President Richard Nixon. This information comes from the calendar, The Hidden History of the United States. Up next, we have Jim Hightower.
Betsy DeVos and her hubby Dick are lucky enough to have inherited a big chunk of the multi-billion dollar fortune that Daddy DeVos amassed through his shady Amway Corporation. But what they've done with their Amway money is certainly not the American way. The DeVos couple are part of the Koch brothers coterie, pushing plutocratic policies that reject our country's one-for-all, all-for-one egalitarianism. In particular, Ms. DeVos has spent years and millions of dollars spreading the right wing's ideological nonsense that our tax dollars should even be given to private schools that exclude people of color and the poor, as well as to profiteering schools known to cheat students and taxpayers. Bizarrely, Donald Trump chose this vehement opponent of public education to head up the agency in charge of, guess what, public education. Rather than working to help improve our public schools, the Trump-DeVos duo wants to take $20 billion from their federal funding and give it to corporate chains. To see the efficiency of this scheme, look to Arizona, where State Senate President Steve Yarbrough pushed privatization into law. One of Arizona's corporatized schools, called Axto, pays its executive director $125,000 a year. His name is Steve Yarbrough. Axto also pays millions of dollars to another for-profit corporation named HY Processing to handle administrative chores. The Y in HY stands for Yarbrough, and Axto also pays $52,000 a year in rent to its landlord. Yes, Steve Yarbrough. This is Jim Hightower saying, as Wall Street banksters, drug company gougers, airline fee fixers, and so many others have taught us over and over, Most corporate executives are paid big bucks to take every shortcut, cheat, and do whatever to squeeze out another dime in profits. Why would we entrust our school children to them?
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
This is KPFT Houston, the program's Progressive Forum, and our guest this evening, William Hartung, is Director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. He is the author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. He's co-editor of Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War. His latest article is The Hidden Cost of National Security, 10 Ways Your Tax Dollars Pay for War, Past, Present, and Future. Bill, welcome back to the Progressive Forum.
Yes, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So let's talk about this article of yours, because I think most people, they think they know how the military budget is set up, but they're probably wrong. You want to let us know when you broke this down to 10 different pieces?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's partly done to disguise the true cost of war. And it takes a little digging to look at all the different pieces of cost of past wars, current wars, planning for future wars. And so these were the 10 categories that popped up. And, you know, there's the regular Pentagon budget, which most people are familiar with, which is about $500 billion a year. Then the money for fighting wars is kept in a separate budget, and that's another $60 to $80 billion a year. And that budget is unlimited, and they can throw as much in there as they would like. Then they do nuclear warheads at the Department of Energy for another $20 billion a year. There's some money for the FBI thrown in, which is military-related. There's military aid, which they put at the State Department. There's, of course, the cost of taking care of our vets, which is mushroomed to about three times what it was before the Afghan and Iraq wars, to $186 billion a year. There's money for the military share of the interest on the debt, which runs about $100 billion a year. There's money for retirement pay for military personnel. The trust fund needs a supplement every year or it would go broke. So these are the basic elements. And you know, I didn't mention the intelligence agencies, of which there are 17, and they cost, as far as we know, about $70 billion a year, but most of that is somehow hidden in the Pentagon's budget, which I've never quite cracked that as to where they're hiding it, but experts tell me that that's how it's done. So all those things together, about double the price to over $1 trillion a year. So if you were just looking at the Pentagon budget, you'd only have about half of the picture.
Well, and you mention intelligence agencies, and we have the CIA, which is also involved in actual warfare.
That's right. You know, there's sort of a parallel structure. The CIA, trained and armed its own people in Syria. Of course, they have their own drone program parallel to the one of the Air Force. And, of course, historically, they've been involved in overthrowing governments going all the way back to the Shah of Iran, the coup in Guatemala, the overthrow of the government in Chile, and others. So they're, you know, in theory, when they were set up, they were supposed to gather information, but they're actually a paramilitary organization.
Yeah, and, you know, the drone warfare that they do, you know, it's very secretive, and it's just concerning that, you know, you have the military that's doing drone warfare, and then the CIA is doing their own thing.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, President Obama kind of promised that he was going to make the process more transparent, give more information out. I don't know that he ever got around to doing that, and of course now under Trump, that's certainly not going to happen. But Obama really put drone warfare at the center of U.S. strategy. You know, Bush had hundreds of thousands of troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Obama promised to bring them home, which he didn't, of course, do. But the numbers of troops are significantly less, but it's being supplemented by drone strikes, special forces, arming and training dictatorships, and we're at war in at least seven places at the moment. And that is all a legacy of Obama. So Trump comes in, he says he's going to bomb the hell out of people, he's going to be a tough guy, but he also says he's not going to fight other wars like Iraq. And so what he's basically doing is kind of Obama plus. He's taken the gloves off, they're less discriminating in bombing, there's been more civilian casualties, he's increased troops in Iraq and Syria. He's told the generals to put as many troops in Afghanistan as they would like. But it's not like we moved from, you know, peacetime to a war president. We just have a different kind of war president who's considerably more reckless and certainly a concern. But it's not day and night.
You mentioned about him being reckless. He seems to do things on whims. And having a president with our military at his ready, that's very concerning.
Yes. There's actually a bill in Congress, the Markey-Lew bill, which is trying to prevent the president from being able to unilaterally launch a nuclear war. You know, he would have to go to Congress. Now, the chances of passing that are pretty slim. And also, you know, would Trump actually obey the law, of course? But it's an effort to put a spotlight on that. You know, do you want a guy with this temperament having the capability to launch the most powerful weapons ever built? And it's just one of the concerns, of course. I mean, he's been making noise about Iran, and a war with Iran would be even more disastrous possibly than the war that Bush launched in Iraq. He goes back and forth on North Korea. One day they say, talk to him. The next day, he's going to teach him a lesson. I think the erratic behavior of Trump just adds a new danger to an already dangerous situation.
To follow up on North Korea, I mean, he was really pushing it. Trying to make the North Korean government think that they could be attacked at any time, and it's and you really I wouldn't put it past him.
Well, we don't know what he's capable of doing. I mean, they keep saying that the military leaders are going to restrain him. People like James Mattis, who when he ran the Central Command, actually wanted to attack Iran. Or H.R. McMaster, who actually wrote a very interesting critique of the Vietnam War. But his bottom line was, they should have gone in bigger and harder, not that they shouldn't have fought the war in the first place, which, was, of course, was the, the real answer to that question. We've got this kind of unknowable in the equation, which is what, what's Trump going to wake up and do on any given day? And the best hope is that he's going to blow off steam and say all this stuff and not end up doing it. He's just going to sort of brag about it. But that's kind of a pretty thin reed to put the safety of your country on.
It sure is. And you mentioned the military men that he has in his a cabinet working with and also working with him. What does that say to you that he wants to surround himself with people like this?
Well, I think he has a strong authoritarian streak. I think that explains things like his love affair with Putin.
Mm-hmm.
I think he kind of envies the way Putin is able to run his country in some ways. And I think he likes to project an image of toughness. Of course, he never served in the military. He ducked it. And he even has made ridiculous statements like, going to military school was sort of like being in the military. So he's, I think he looks up to the generals. He seemed to love the fact that James Mattis's nickname was Mad Dog. I mean, he was just, gushing about this when he appointed the guy. Apparently, Mattis himself is kind of embarrassed by this nickname, but Trump loves it, So I think you know, he views them as strong, he views them as decisive. But, of course, we're supposed to have some sort of civilian control of the military. But when you have a military person as your Secretary of Defense and a military person running your National Security Council and a military person running Homeland Security, you're pretty moving right along towards a military government. And then, of course, the other choices have their own problems. The head of Exxon running the State Department.
Yeah.
A long list of people out of the military contracting community coming into the government. Mattis came from General Dynamics. His deputy came from Boeing. The civilian SC was also with, you know, coming out of the contracting world. So it's, you know, it's kind of the military-industrial complex run wild, you know, kind of beyond anything that probably Eisenhower would have imagined when he coined the term.
Well, and going back to your book about the military-industrial complex, that, you know, wait a second, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. I had you on a while back talking about that, and this, you know, the military, that's a real money-making operation.
Well, it's huge. I mean, the, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars a year, about half of what the Pentagon gets, goes right back out the door to contractors. So it's a huge money-making machine for Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics and Boeing and Northrop Grumman and hundreds and thousands of other firms that are subcontractors. But, you know, in a good year, I mean, good for Lockheed Martin, not good for us, they'll get as much as $40 billion in federal contracts, which is bigger than the operating budget of the State Department. So it's just another example of how skewed our priorities are. And I think a lot of people, they think of the Pentagon, they think, oh, the money's going to the troops. But a lot of it's going to the contractors. And, you know, it's ubiquitous. I mean, they've got people doing everything from, you know, writing intelligence briefs to the president to, you know, doing all kinds of bureaucratic work for the Pentagon to carrying guns in war zones. They have about 600,000 or 700,000 contractors that the Pentagon employs, and they actually can't even keep track of them. You know, Robert Gates, when he was Secretary of Defense, tried to do a count, and they couldn't figure it out. And then they set up an office to do that, and the office was gutted. You know, they got rid of the key personnel who would have been able to tell us. So you've got close to 1 million civilians in the Pentagon. You've got 700,000 contractors, and then you've also got our uniformed military. But the bureaucrats and the contractors are larger than the regular military in terms of just numbers.
Well, and I read something recently about them wanting to, boost the number of contractors in Afghanistan. What is, you know, their what is it that makes them want to bring in contractors instead of servicemen?
I think there's a couple things. One is, I mean, it's just payback. I mean, it's, you know, it's greasing the skids for contractors, which is done across the board. But I think also they view it as giving them more flexibility. You can hire a contractor, you can fire them. They often hire people who've been in special forces, Navy SEALs, and so forth, who are actually quite experienced. But they have much more flexibility in how they use them. And so I think that's part of it. Also, if a contractor is wounded or killed in battle, it doesn't get the same public attention
yeah.
as when it happens to a service, somebody in the military services. So there's kind of a political angle there, which is the whole thrust during Obama was to kind of mask the consequences of war because the drones put fewer U.S. troops at risk. There's fewer troops on the ground. A lot of the dying is being done by people from other countries or people who are not being, are not discussed. And so, you know, I think the use of contractors fits in with that model as well of a more politically sustainable interventionary force, which is, doesn't generate the same kind of public backlash as if you were losing uniformed service personnel in these conflicts.
You know, it all seems so calculating, the way that the money is spread out over these different agencies, the fact that you have civilians dying instead of military. Now, what is your take on this, the way that this is set up?
Well, I think, you know, going back to when they stopped calling it the War Department,
yeah,
it's always been a little bit about kind of anesthetizing people about war. And there's a much smaller percentage of people fighting in wars than was the case in World War II, which was all hands on deck and millions of people. And so I think, you know, from the point of view of the Pentagon or the government, if people, you know, like George W. Bush said, oh, just go shopping and don't worry about it, I think the extent to which they can kind of wall off the consequences so the average person doesn't have to think about it, then it's easier to go to war. So I think a lot of it has to do with that.
Yeah, and it's real troubling because if we're going to go to war, if we're going to risk the lives of our service people, but also going to risk the lives of people in foreign countries, you know, people should be concerned about it. It shouldn't be something that's taken lightly.
Exactly. No, there should be much more debate. I mean, even just the economic costs. I mean, there's a project at Brown University called the Cost of War Project, which figured out that the cost of Iraq and Afghanistan, if you count not just only the cost on the battlefield, but the cost of taking care of vets and all the related ongoing costs that happen after a war ends. Of course, these wars haven't really ended. $4.7 trillion over a decade. So that would be enough to, you know, eliminate all these budget caps and deal with all this deficit reduction they're talking about and have trillions left over to invest in things we need in the country. So, but when the Iraq War started, the Bush people were saying, oh, yeah, it'll be quick and it'll cost, you know, maybe $50 billion. So it cost about 20 times that just in terms of, you know, direct budgetary costs and even beyond that in terms of the ongoing consequences. And it's been huge. I mean, there's apparently over 300,000 vets from Iraq and Afghanistan who've been dealing with, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injuries or, you know, so they've, it's kind of the curse of the modern medical system. They've saved people's lives in ways they couldn't, which is hugely important. But the number of people wounded has gone up dramatically in these conflicts.
Well, we've got about a minute left. You want to wrap this up?
Well, I think the main thing is people shouldn't get discouraged and people should fight back. You know, because you look at this thing and it's so huge and it's so kind of, you know, got so many tentacles. But there are groups pushing back. I mean, there's groups like Win Without War, there's the Friends Committee on National Legislation, there's Peace Action, and there's people who aren't part of named groups who are starting to realize we can't let the Pentagon, you know, devour our budget when people have so many other needs. So I think we're in a tough spot now for sure, but I think it's important to get on a footing of resistance and not just let the information wash over us and give us another reason to you know, be afraid or be discouraged.
Bill, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Our guest has been William Hartung. He's the director of the Arms and Security Project, and his latest article is The Hidden Cost of National Security, 10 Ways Your Tax Dollars Pay for Wars Past, Present, and Future. Up next, we have Lillian Kerr with a bird's eye view.
A Bird's Eye View, A Woman's Perspective with Lillian Kerr. This is a brief biography of Harriet Tubman, and this information comes from womenshistory.about.com. Harriet Tubman led over 200 slaves to freedom as a conductor of the Underground Railroad, Contemporaries called her Moses and General Tubman in praise of her bravery and leadership. In 1821, Harriet Tubman was born into slavery on a plantation in Dorchester County, Maryland. Her name at birth was Araminta Ross. When she was 11, Araminta chose a new name to signal her coming of age, her mother's name, Harriet. At the age of 5, young Harriet began working as a house slave, doing chores like weaving. When she was 12, her master moved her into the fields to work. Harriet was brave and confident from an early age. As a teenager, she moved to defend a fellow slave from the violence of an overseer, taking a blow from a heavy weight that was thrown at her compatriot. Harriet suffered the effects of this head injury for the rest of her life. Harriet took the surname Tubman when she married John Tubman in 1844. John was free, and he never understood why his wife longed to escape to the North for her own freedom. They parted ways when she finally escaped. In 1849, the master of Harriet's plantation died, and she began to worry that all of the slaves of the plantation would be sold. Slaves who lived in Upper South states like Maryland lived in fear of being sold away from their families to the Deep South, where the work was backbreaking and the punishments harsher. Harriet made the decision to escape. Tubman ran away at night with the assistance of white abolitionists. Harriet Tubman made contact with abolitionists in Philadelphia, including William Still, a famous conductor on the Underground Railroad. The Underground Railroad was a network of individuals who escorted escaping slaves from the South to safety in the North. After Tubman's rescue of her sister and her children, Philadelphia abolitionists inducted into the Underground Railroad, giving her the details of the routes they used and swearing her to secrecy. Between 1851 and 1860, Tubman made 19 trips as a conductor on the Underground Railroad. She rescued her parents and other family members, as well as other slaves desirous of freedom. She was proud of never incurring any casualties on these trips. All of her passengers made it to the North safely. Tubman operated in strict secrecy, and the details of many of her trips remain unknown. She believed that God had orchestrated her freedom so that she could help other slaves to escape. In addition to her faith, Tubman's cool temperament and courage made her a particularly successful conductor. On one trip, she brandished a rifle at a passenger who wanted to turn back, explaining that a live runaway could do a great harm by going back, but a dead one could tell no secrets, according to William Still in The Underground Railroad, published in 1872. On another trip, she gave a harmless drug that acted as a sedative to a crying baby to avoid detection. If Tubman became aware that she and her group were being followed, she was not afraid to go even deeper into the South to lose the trail. Tubman's success at escorting slaves to freedom became so well known that by 1856, Southern slaveholders were offering a $40,000 reward for her capture. Tubman continued her work with the Underground Railroad right up until 1860. When war broke out in 1861, Tubman, who was living safely in Canada, returned to the South to work for the Union Army. She believed that the outbreak of war indicated that slavery would soon be abolished and wanted to help hasten its ending. During the war, she worked as a nurse, ministering to slaves who escaped their masters to join the Union Army. In 1863, Tubman became a spy for Colonel James Montgomery, putting together a network of spies who apprised him of slaves who wanted to escape and become Union soldiers. She also worked as a scout for Montgomery's Combahee River raid into South Carolina, which freed nearly 500 slaves. And that was a biography of Harriet Tubman. And this has been Lillian Kerr with A Bird's Eye View.
And this is Wally James. And our next guest, Zachary Neely, is an 18-year-old graduate of Strake Jesuit College Preparatory, and he wrote a powerful op-ed published by the Houston Chronicle on July 8th, titled U.S. Conflicts Don't Stay Abroad, They Hit Close to Home. Zach is a committee member of the Foreign Policy FPA. is a right-left coalition for reforming interventionist U.S. policies. Zach, welcome to the Progressive Forum.
Good to be with you, Wally.
Start off with what motivated you to write this article?
Well, a couple things, really. First off, as I was drafting the article, I kind of want to pose myself a few questions. What am I really trying to answer? If I was to write something and it was to be an answer to the question, what would that question be? And that question ended up being, how can I get somebody like me, 18 years old, maybe 20 years old, 25 years old, how can I get them to care about what's going on halfway across the world, 6, 7, 8, 10,000 miles away? And, the product was that article, and it was being able to relate to somebody who, that was kind of a little bit relatable, but I never met the person who, I wrote the article about, but he did graduate from the same high school as me. So that was kind of my relation, and I was able to kind of paint a bit of a picture, being able to relate to Mr., Sergeant Moriarty. And, I kind of did a little bit of a springboard off of that, and I kind of connected. I think the idea was kind of in there. It was kind of implied that, behind every face, every soldier that we lose over the Middle East, every U.S. soldier, there's a family behind them. There's people, there's friends and family, and then there's people like me who kind of, know who this person is. So, so that was kind of my point. I wanted to make it relatable, and I wanted people to be able to start caring and start asking big questions about foreign policy. Why is it that we spend so much money on wars that, haven't really made us very safe? And you could go back, a decade and a half with these wars.
And James Montgomery, when he was killed, this was a story that that was well covered, because you had three Green Berets killed at one time. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. So first off, I want to go ahead and address something that just recently came out.
Sure.
To the viewers who are listening, there was a video that recently came out, surveillance footage. Because this took place, what I mainly wrote my article about was what happened was these four Green Berets, they were coming back from a training mission over in Jordan. They were near, I believe it was the near Al Jafar, Jordan. It was the King Faisal Air Base. And as they were pulling in, one of the guards had decided to, I think he thought the base, this is what he said, he thought the base was under attack, and then he opened fire on the Americans. He killed two of them instantly, and then for about 4 or 5 minutes, he kind of stalks the last two guys of some sort. I don't know how else to describe it. And eventually, the soldier, his name is, I believe, Mark Al-Tawaya. I think I said that right. And he eventually rushes the last two Green Berets who are still alive. One of them ends up going down, and that is Sergeant James Moriarty, and that is a person who graduated from my high school, and that is a person I wrote my article about. But anyways, there's video footage that just came out. The Jordanian government released it. I encourage people to go and look it up, watch it, and, I think it's very powerful. It's a lot more than just reading words on a page, like three guys just went down about a base in Jordan. It's much more personal. It's much more relatable when, you watch these people go down on camera.
Obviously. I mean, it's going to be much more gut-wrenching. We're used to film and, people being shot and it's all fake. But, when you're looking at something and a human being is being killed, not literally in front of you, but on that film, it's very disturbing.
Right. It was terrible for me to watch, and it must have been horrible because for the families to watch, the families of the fallen soldiers, because they were shown this video, I think it was 6 or 7 months ago, and they've been pressuring the Jordanian government to release it. So I want to go ahead and congratulate those families on managing to get this released and let people see this and see, you know, and draw their own conclusions from it. Because I hopefully we get to talk about this tonight. What I think is probably a failure of foreign policy. I think probably if you look down to the roots of it, I think that's probably what got these soldiers killed. Because we can look at this video and say, oh, that Jordanian guard who hid in the little shack off the camera, you know, he could have done something, or the cars passing by could have done something. Or maybe if the soldiers ran some other direction. We can put blame and whatever, we can go ahead and speculate. But that's all in the past. You know, we can't change that. But we can change the future. We can go ahead and shape our foreign policy to where we can stop more James Moriarty's, you know, from, you know, getting killed like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a total waste for, you know, people to be killed. And in war, there is so much killing. And a lot of times there is an effort to try and sanitize it. Like when Bush was in, and it was the Iraq War, they refused to let photographers photograph the coffins that were coming mm-hmm. back with soldiers in them.
Yeah, I think, you know, it kind of makes me wonder, you know, to what extent people, and I think my article is kind of targeted towards people, you know, who clamor for more and more war. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what goes through their mind. I don't. But I want to know that there is a human cost to going to war. There was a human cost to going to war in Iraq. There was a human cost going to war in Afghanistan. There's a human cost in putting troops in Syria, in Jordan, in Iraq. And I don't know. It's just kind of like, it's a little frustrating almost that after 16 years of perpetual war, that we still haven't, you know, learned our lesson, you know, especially from, you know, Iraq, Libya, Syria, where we think we can make some sort of difference with toppling regimes or trying to put down terrorist groups. Because, you know, we need to think about, you know, going to war because there's unintended consequences.
There is. I mean, we go into Iraq and then, you know, Al-Qaeda comes out of that. It's just the idea that you're going to go in and fix everything with bombing and shooting, and all we did was just destroy that country and made it easier for a terrorist group to come in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So case in point, you know, I believe that there's a cholera epidemic or a cholera outbreak in Yemen.
Mm-hmm. There is, yeah.
You know, if anybody's not familiar with it, you know, currently right now in Yemen, it's currently split kind of evenly between the government and the rebels that are there. And people are like, well, what does that have to do with anything? Well, the thing is, I believe it's, you know, the Saudi Arabian government funds the Yemeni government, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. And
you're right. Go ahead.
Okay. In the U.S., I don't know if it passed or not, but they were considering, you know, a $300 billion arms deal. $300 billion. They were considering sending that much money over to Saudi Arabia, and, you know, God knows where that money would go, but it probably would have went to funding, you know, the government over in Yemen. And that just continues. It's a continual cycle. You know, we continue to just pump money into these wars, and then, you know, guess what? There's a cholera epidemic because all the infrastructure is destroyed. The healthcare services are down. You know, people can't get access to healthcare, and now you have this outbreak. So that's an unintended consequence. But, you know, when you talk about countries like Iraq, you know, what could happen if we go and try to, you know, alter the regime there? And, you know, we kind of got that answer a few years after we, you know, left, you know, ISIS took over the country, or almost did.
Yeah. And you're asking, you know, why, or that's the way I took it, why we're doing that. And it's because corporations in this country make a lot of money when we sell these large amounts of weapons.
They do. There's a I think you're talking about earlier with your other guest,
William Hartung,
military-industrial complex of sorts, where you know these people get these contracts and you know they do make you know some level of money. I don't know how much. I imagine it's probably a lot because these contracts do go for you know millions, billions of dollars. I haven't studied the issue incredibly, but yeah, there are people who do make some money off of that, and it's not a 100% terrible thing. Because people would argue, well, our military needs to be up to date. We got to make sure we have the best military in the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, when these people, groups, companies, whatever you want to call them, you know, start nudging the government a little bit and say, hey, maybe we should go to war, you know, that's when it starts to become a problem.
Yeah. We've got about 2 minutes left. You want to take this time to wrap this up for us?
Okay. So, one last thing I want to talk about, you know, while you mentioned earlier, you know, I was a member, or I am a member, of the Foreign Policy Alliance.
Yes.
And it's a brand new group. It's been around for a couple of years. It's based here in Houston. And basically, it's a brand new multi-partisan coalition designed to advocate for a less costly and more effective foreign policy. To be more specific, we're aiming for foreign policy that's non-interventionist. We're aiming for a budget to be reduced, you know, alliances to be, you know, kind of adjusted a little bit, you know, and amongst other things as well. And, you know, we're also calling into question, you know, why do we spend so much blood, so many lives, you know, all the way across the globe, different countries, you know, in seemingly pointless wars, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, why do we maintain more than over 700 military bases? You know, why is the Pentagon getting so much money? And, you know, I think your viewers will probably like this one a little bit. I may not agree with 100%, but, you know, why does the military budget get to go up and why does everything else cut, like social programs, welfare, you know, that sort of thing? You know, why does that have to get cut? Military budget goes up funding these wars. So I think that's what the Foreign Policy Alliance stands for. And if any of your viewers would like to, they can go online at www.foreignpolicyalliance.org. You can check out our resolution. I think, you know, most people probably would go on there and say, yeah, I think I agree with this. And if they want to, consider endorsing it. We would certainly love a couple endorsements if you do agree with, you know, what we have to stand for. And, you know, beyond that, I think it serves another purpose, and I think a lot of the members of the group are kind of a little bit oblivious to this of sorts, but, you know, it's a left-right convergence of some sort. And I think, you know, considering the toxicity of our politics today, you know, where you can't even get people to kind of interact with each other, people from different ideologies like progressives and conservatives, they won't even sit down with each other. Oh, you're a progressive, you're conservative. I disagree with everything you have to say. You know, I don't like you because you believe, you know, X needs to happen or whatever. And I think that this is an opportunity to go ahead and build some bridges of some sorts between, you know, progressives, libertarians, conservatives, Republicans, Democrats, you know, all these different groups of people, and get them around, at least sit at the table and be able to discuss an issue that they agree with. I think that it can fix our politics. I really think so.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Zachary Neely. He has an article, U.S. Conflicts, Don't Stay Abroad, They Hit Close to Home. It's at the Houston Chronicle. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. Coming up next, we have our calendar of events with Mary Hanks.
This is Mary Hanks with the Progressive Forum Calendar of Events. 3 minutes to help you change the world. Please note that admission charges and other fees may apply and that events are subject to alteration or cancellation without notice. Friday, July 28th, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Film Selection Viewing Party to help decide which movies should be shown at next year's Wild and Scenic Film Festival. At the Citizens Environmental Coalition, 751 Silver Street, Suite 111. For more information, visit cechouston.org. Saturday, July 29th, 7:30 a.m. to noon, volunteers are needed to sort school supplies for under-resourced students at Faith Lutheran Church, 4600 Bel Air Boulevard. For more information, visit the Facebook page for CCSC Christian Community Service Center. Sunday, July 30th, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., join the Street Food Houston volunteers to prepare and serve delicious meals to hungry people downtown. Meet at Midtown Kitchen Collective, 2505 Fannin. For more information, find this event on Facebook, BBQ Jackfruit Greens and Cornbread. And this will be on the Street Food Houston Facebook page. Tuesday, August 1st, 6:30 to 9 p.m., Solar to the People, featuring presentations on building your own solar power system and making your home more energy efficient. At Haven Center, 1827 West Alabama. For more information, visit transitionhouston.org. Wednesday, August 2nd, 6:30 to 9:30 p.m., Human Trafficking Talk and Bus Tour, to learn about the red flags and actual locations of human trafficking in our area. At Children at Risk, 2900 Wesleyan, Suite 400. For fees and other information, visit childrenatrisk.org. And save the date for this event next week, Friday, August 4th, 8:30 a.m. to 3 p.m., the 2017 Greater Houston Environmental Summit and Environmental Education Expo at the United Way Service Center, 50 Wall Drive. For fees and other information, visit cechouston.org. This has been the Progressive Forum Calendar of Events. The Progressive Forum airs Thursday evenings from 7 to 9 on KPFT Houston, but you can make a date with progress right now.
This is the news on the Progressive Forum. I'm Larry Krizan. Environmental justice is an issue of pressing concern for Americans, but more so for people of color. There's a direct link between race, class, and environmental injustice. African Americans are on the forefront of this environmental crisis in the country. Their communities suffer from disproportionate exposure to lead paint and the chance of living in proximity to landfills and toxic waste sites, causing harm to their health and well-being. As another example of this environmental racism, the U.S. Army has hundreds of thousands of explosive waste incinerated by a private contractor in Colfax, Louisiana. That contractor is Clean Harbors, LLC, a longtime Defense Department contractor and one of the largest hazardous waste handlers in North America. Colfax is located in central Louisiana, about 25 miles from Alexandria. Colfax's majority African-American community and is impoverished, with an average yearly income of around $14,000. The Colfax, Louisiana plant is the only commercial facility in the U.S. allowed to burn explosives and munition waste with absolutely no environmental emissions controls. The U.S. Army's outdated munitions are burned on the grounds of the Clean Harbors plant that fuel raging fires, spewing smoke into the air just hundreds of yards from the Colfax community. As the Environmental Protection Agency has no oversight whatsoever, Colfax's 1,532 residents are correct to fear for their health and safety. They live in extremely close proximity to the destruction of these toxic byproducts of our war economy. The Colfax plant has been in business for the military for decades, and over the years, the Clean Harbors facility there has become an important clearinghouse for military-related waste. This comes as the Department of Defense and its contractors attempt to deal with the hazardous byproducts from weapons manufacturing and huge stockpiles of aging munitions. For years, defense-related firms have burned this waste at their own facilities. But incineration permits have become harder to get, terms less flexible, and increasingly the pollution unacceptable to surrounding communities. In 2015 alone, 700,000 pounds of military-related munitions and explosives were trucked to Colfax for incineration. In Colfax, Louisiana, both Clean Harbors LLC and the U.S. military have been able to outmaneuver the local community. The people there have abundant concerns, little money, and even less political influence to fight back against the contamination of their town. Every year, military bases and defense contractors send munitions or other explosive material to Colfax. Delivery manifests filed with Louisiana regulators detail the variety of materials. Rocket fuel from Los Angeles, hand grenades from Arkansas, detonating fuses from Cincinnati, solid propellant from Virginia, explosive lead from North Carolina, and warhead rockets from Alabama. Once these products are received, the explosive materials are burned on a set of 20 metal-lined pans on a large patch of concrete in the open air. Clean Harbors Senior Vice President for Compliance and Regulatory Affairs says the burns are performed with no risk to human health or the environment. These burns take place several times each day. Last November, Louisiana State environmental officials parked an air monitoring van on Bush Road, about 3 miles from Colfax downtown. Lab samples they obtained show environmental regulators detected notable levels of acrolein, a highly toxic vapor commonly occurring with open burns of munitions. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention state that acrolein causes severe respiratory problems and heart attacks, even at low doses and for as long as 18 months after its exposure. The lab reports also showed low levels of other volatile organic compounds, including benzene, a known carcinogen. The World Health Organization warns benzene has no safe level of exposure. Soil, groundwater, and stream beds sampled on the Clean Harbors site over the past few months have also found to contain an array of extremely harmful substances likely connected with the burning of munitions waste. Louisiana state inspections have found Clean Harbors LLC in violation of a number of regulations, handling hazardous waste in unpermitted ways, failing to make repairs to its burn pads, and discharging unauthorized pollutants in violation of its state water permit. This burn facility first opened in Colfax more than 30 years ago, and Clean Harbors acquired it in 2002 from a company called Safety Clean. Clean Harbors says today it's a squeaky clean operation, and it dismisses the contamination findings. That company says the acrolein and benzene contamination were caused by something other than the facility. Clean Harbors LLC says that the other contaminants are either contained within their 740-acre property or exist at such low concentrations they don't pose a risk to human health. Once again, the forces of the United States war economy and its byproducts are unleashed upon the citizens of this country, with a secondary profit made off the destruction of outdated weapons of death. In their bids to pass health care legislation, euphemistically saying, by trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, Senate Republicans have apparently succeeded where their Democratic opponents had failed. Republicans have made the health care legislation known as Obamacare popular among a majority of Americans. Support for the Affordable Care Act has risen dramatically since the 2016 election, with more people now viewing the Affordable Care Act favorably than unfavorably. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates that both the House and Senate proposals to replace the law would result in over 20 million more uninsured Americans. The shift in the nation's mood also reflects a strong increase for support for Medicaid, this health insurance program for the poor that the Affordable Care Act expanded. Medicaid expansion now covers far more people, and this expansion faces the deepest cuts in its 52-year history under these Republican plans. After the so-called success of Trump's campaign promising its base smaller government, Republicans in Congress are now working in opposition to a growing national consensus that the government should guarantee health insurance to all. One example is a Pew survey from this January, which states that 60% of Americans believe that the government should be responsible for ensuring that all Americans have health care. That number was increased from only 51% last year. Senate Republicans have no plan to pass quality encompassing health care legislation. Their repeal-only plan would leave some 20 million previously covered Americans without insurance. Interestingly enough, the Senate parliamentarian has advised Republicans last Friday that key conservative agenda items do not comply with Senate rules on reconciliation. This is the fast-track procedure the GOP is trying to cram down the repeal of Affordable Care Act with. Some of the Republican actions out of compliance include defunding Planned Parenthood for 1 year and banning coverage of abortion in Affordable Care Act insurance plans. The 52 Senate Republicans would need to muster 60 votes to preserve each provision flagged by the parliamentarian for potentially violating the so-called Byrd Rule. The parliamentarian's guidance amounts to a significant win for Democrats, who are aiming to eliminate as many draconian provisions from the Republican health care bill as possible. And in our final story, President Trump's campaign against environmental regulations continues as a new Republican director has the EPA rejecting a proposed rule that would ban a brain-damaging pesticide. The decision by President Trump's Environmental Protection Agency is to rebuff the advice of its own scientists to ban this neurotoxic pesticide called chlorpyrifos. This ignorant decision has prompted protests from California's farm workers' communities who are demanding an immediate statewide ban of the dangerous chemical. A farm worker delegation has delivered more than 167,000 petition signatures, along with a letter signed by 75 organizations representing hundreds of thousands of Californians. EPA scientists have previously documented that chlorpyrifos can cause serious and profound neurological and respiratory damage. Even in minuscule doses, the pesticide can cause developmental delays, autism, and IQ loss for children. Each year in California, more than 1 million pounds of this neurotoxic organophosphate pesticide are used. Much of chlorpyrifos is used in close proximity to schools and homes. The use of pesticide in California accounts for roughly 10% of the nationwide total. Chlorpyrifos is applied on dozens of crops grown in California. Californians for Pesticide Reform is a statewide coalition of more than 190 organizations. They say that after years of stalling, the EPA was set to implement a ban on chlorpyrifos use on food crops this March. Then, new EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt reversed the EPA's plan. Mr. Pruitt announced he was allowing continued agricultural use of chlorpyrifos. This decision by Pruitt came after intense pressure from Dow Chemical, the largest manufacturer of this dangerous pesticide. Last November, the EPA announced that it intended to revoke all food tolerances of chlorpyrifos, calling exposure to any amount unsafe. Underscoring the importance of this proposed ban, the EPA cited the serious dangers of chlorpyrifos exposure and added that young children risk exposure from food residues alone that are 140 times higher than the level EPA currently believes is safe. And that's been some of the news on the Progressive Forum.
Houston's premier summertime party happens this July 29th. The 31st annual Watermelon Dance and Summer Social. This KPFT benefit takes place at the Last Concert Cafe. Located at 1403 Nance Street, the Last Concert Cafe is easily found just off the Hardy McKee exit on I-10. Once inside, you'll be treated to icy cold watermelon, thanks to Trader Joe's, great food, cold drinks, music to dance to, and the company of your fellow KPFT listeners. The all-day and all-night event features some of Houston's best talent and all over a dozen music acts will perform for your ears' delight. KPFT would like to thank its sponsors, and there's plenty of time to join Andy Upshaw, Nick Economides, Catherine Shockley, and Margaret M. Connolly Law. If you're interested, contact deadbeat@kpft.org. The door fee, which goes directly to KPFT, is $20 for one or $30 if you come as a couple. It's July 29th for the 31st annual Watermelon Dance and Summer Social, so stop dreaming. It's time to feast on the other red meat. See you July 29th at the Last Concert Cafe, Community Radio 90.1. KPFT, Houston.
No matter where you are on the political spectrum, KPFT is a daily check-in on the workings of democracy. Part of a democracy is an independent press and media. Media like this is supposed to be the check and balance on government. And community radio is one of the few media outlets left that is completely independent. That's why, in this age of the greatest media consolidation America has ever seen, having different voices out there is essential. KPFT has been around since 1970, and we have survived through the contributions of people like you. Listeners who donate to KPFT support us because they know that's what keeps KPFT independent. Why wait for a pledge drive? You can join KPFT online at kpft.org. Thomas Jefferson said, "People cannot be both ignorant and free." Help keep KPFT vibrant with your financial contribution. Visit kpft.org to join securely online. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
And you're listening to the Progressive Forum. We come to you every Thursday night. Well, almost every Thursday night. This is KPFT Houston. Coming up next, we have a talk, and the speaker is Anthony DiMaggio, and it's titled "Capitalism: Does Capitalism Have a Future?" And he's also co-author with Paul Street of the book "The Rise of the Tea Party." His latest article is "Higher Education Fallacies: What's Behind the Rise of Conservative Distrust of Learning." This audio comes to us from Open University of the Left and was recorded on July 21st.
I just want to thank everybody for being here. So I was really trying to do two things with this presentation. First, talk about why there's a mounting crisis in the United States, not just economically, but politically. I would say it's an emerging crisis at this point. It could be worse, of course. Things can always be worse. But also, what's impeding or stopping or preventing some sort of transformational change in American politics and society? So we are in a crisis period, I think, an emerging crisis, whether people recognize it or not. I think a lot of people don't, if you look at public opinion polls. But there are enough people that are beginning to recognize some of the problems we're facing that we can start to talk about prospects for change. I really don't think that we're further than that at this point in terms of mapping out any sort of major societal transformation in institutions. So in some sense, that is very encouraging because it means there's all types of possibilities that are hopeful, but also we're not where we need to be or even close to it, so that's very challenging as well. It can be somewhat frustrating and depressing. So everything I'm going to say here in terms of where the system is going, our political and economic system, we have to understand this is tentative. We're looking at one point in time where things could change in terms of the prospects for some sort of major upheaval in society or transformation or revolutionary politics. That may or may not happen. A lot of people on the left like to say that look at politics only in terms of revolutionary change, and that may happen, it may not, but what I'm talking about here is where we are headed if we don't change what we're currently doing and what we've been seeing. So I think when we talk about crisis, there's really basically about four points I was thinking about that would, I think, reveal that there is a crisis going on. Now, a lot of people haven't really thought about these things, but they're worth thinking about. Number one is economic growth. We now live in a period where this system can no longer produce the kind of economic growth that people expect it to provide for not only corporate profits, but a rising standard of living for the average person. In the United States, people have long liked to pride themselves in this idea that if you work hard, you can get ahead, and that requires significant economic growth and profits, and we are at a point now where if you look at the last 10 years, 2008 to 2016, we've averaged during that period about 1.2% economic growth per year, which means you've entered a period of stagnation. That barely surpasses population growth, which is around 1% a year in the United States. Why does that matter? Well, you know, if you're advocating for a system outside of capitalism, it doesn't necessarily matter if you're not seeing significant economic growth past population growth per year. You could certainly make an argument for systems that don't require growth past population growth in terms of your economy, but this system is based on that, the idea of ever-increasing profits. And this system no longer exists on a level that can provide for not only economic growth, but growth for individuals in terms of growing incomes and corporate profits. So it's a stagnant system. And the system is based on growth and growth in profits and growth in people's incomes in terms of expectations. And we don't have that anymore. If you want a comparison point, you can look at the 1940s through the 1990s. And you can see that the economic growth rate per year in that period, there was a range, a low of about 4% to a high of about 7.5% a year. So now we're talking about 1.2%. This is the weakest growth we've ever seen in post-World War II history, year after year. So that's important, you know, that the system isn't able to sustain what people have expected it to sustain in the past. We also need to talk about financialization. The rise of financialization means that you have banks and finance sector and investors who have basically become the predominant part of the American economy. Well, why is that a concern? Because with the lack of regulation, you're talking about cycles now of instability and a growth now of what you might call structural instability, in the sense that without regulating the banks and ownership rules for the banks and creating actual situations where banks can become, they won't become too big to fail. If you don't have these kinds of ownership rules and restrictions to regulate these banks, then they'll do what they want and think that they'll get bailed out if they engage in all types of speculation. And without regulations, we have this kind of speculative-based economy today where with finance running the economy, it's not that these individuals are any longer making things, they're just speculating on investments. Whether we're talking about the internet tech bubble of the 1990s, which crashed by 2000, or the housing bubble, or what's going to come next, we seem to be averaging one every decade now. Is it going to be housing again? Is it going to be the student loan bubble this next time around? I don't know what it's going to be. Maybe it'll be a combination of things or something we haven't seen before. But with the rise of speculative finance, we're now seeing a pattern of this boom and bust economy during a time where the economy itself is just no longer very strong in terms of talking about this 1% growth. So this adds more instability to what we're already talking about in terms of this anemic growth. Add to that economic insecurity, and you've got now three problems. We live in an era of record profits, but also record inequality. And if there isn't really economic growth to outpace population growth, so where are these record profits coming from then, if it's not really coming from economic growth? Well, the simple answer would be cannibalism, to put it metaphorically, that companies have found a way to make record profits without really much of any economic growth. They do that by going after things like workers, salaries, incomes, pensions, benefits, forcing people to work longer for less money, the rise of this alternative work economy, or gig economy as it's called. These are all important things to point out here. And it is a broken economy, whether people realize it or not. There was a recent Princeton study that found in the last 10 years, 94% of the new jobs created were alternative work arrangement jobs, which mean that they were either people on call or on contracts, temporary workers, freelance. Why does this matter? Well, some of these jobs pay pretty well. A lot of them, many of them don't. I can speak from my own experiences in higher education, talking about people who are non-tenure track faculty, who adjunct, and they get paid nearly nothing. They have no benefits in terms of retirement, or barely any. Healthcare benefits, basically non-existent, and low pay that qualifies people with graduate degrees for welfare benefits. So this is an economy that's really fundamentally different than the idea of a career-based economy, that 94% of new jobs in the last decade have been alternative work arrangements. It means this economy does not function for the average person any longer. I think if you put these things together, what we're seeing now with the American public is a vague sort of anger that's been emerging in the last, particularly the last decade, really, in post-2008. If the 2000s were marked by, especially the early 2000s, sort of a suspension of disbelief with 9/11 and the war on terrorism, and this idea that you have to be patriotic and not criticize your president or your government, we've really moved to the opposite of that, where we have a record amount of anger and distrust of governments, major business entities, corporations. And to give you some examples of this, we now have a president who came into office with the lowest approval rating of a president in history. Well, we could say history of recorded polls, right? Since post-World War II. We've never seen a president this unpopular coming into office. He's somewhere in the 30s now, less than, really about 6 months into this administration. That's incredible. We've never seen that before in modern times. A third of Americans in some recent polls say that they're optimistic about the future and about the US economy. So when I say there's this vague sense of anger and distrust, that's an indication of it. Only one third of Americans say they admire wealthy people or rich people, so there's this vague sense of distrust when it comes to wealth as well. Two thirds of Americans approximately say inequality is too high, and most say government should do something about it to fix it. starts to get complicated when you get into the actual details, especially when you have people voting for parties, in this case a Republican or Democratic party, that are have been committed to increasing inequality in recent decades. So, but we're talking about general principles here, not the sort of the gears of how this all works in government. Three quarters of Americans say that they think businesses and corporations have too much power. So these are the kinds of metrics I'm talking about when I say that there is a generalized, somewhat vague sense of anger and distrust in the United States that could be capitalized on if done properly. One other thing, ecological crisis. This is not something I focus a huge amount in my work, but it is something that we need to talk about. On the current path, if we don't make the changes that we need to in terms of runaway climate change, that, in my mind, would probably represent, and I think does represent, the biggest existential crisis to this system we're talking about that has existed in this country. Politically, economically, you're talking about entire societies and civilizations under pressure, stress, potentially collapsing. Depending on the scientific estimates, we're talking about right now a range of ideas somewhere between 2 to 6 degrees Celsius of warming over the next century through 2100, according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the big intergovernmental group that deals with these projections. They have said, well, in order to avoid more than 2 degrees of warming, which is considered anything past that as becoming radically dangerous in terms of human sustainability and other species and environmental sustainability in general, in order to avoid more than that, we would have to have a leveling off of CO2 emissions by 2030, which is what this Paris Accord was supposed to be about, which we are not on pace right now to meet, especially if we don't recognize that it exists as something that binds us, which we don't anymore. And a total elimination of CO2 emissions by 2070 to 2100, complete elimination. If we don't do these things, the projections that we're hearing about in terms of effects are getting pretty frightening. Predictions for coastlines and flooding and coastal flooding of somewhere between 30 to 80 feet. A global displacement of the human population of maybe as much as a fifth or more. 1 in 5 people being displaced. Up to a third of the U.S. corn crop being destroyed, at least, maybe more, depending on if these estimates, well, they might be worse than some of the conservative estimates scientists have made in terms of how much warming we're going to see. Half of people throughout the world dealing with the problem of severe water shortages by 2050, which is not that far away, realistically. Another recent study, a peer-reviewed study, said that if you talk about the hottest days, the unusual days in the United States and elsewhere between 1950 and 1980, which occurred only about 5% of the time, that those would become regular. Those would become something that would occur 70% of the time by 2035 to 2064 if we don't take the drastic steps that are needed to deal with this problem. And we've already heard scientists begin to talk about a sixth mass extinction event in the last 450 million years, that we're in the middle of it right now. So regardless of whether Americans want another system or any system, we're rapidly moving toward an intensifying of the crisis within this system, especially when you have an economy and an economic system based on the idea of endless growth based on fossil fuels. So it's possible that all of these things I'm talking about could change in the next 20 to 30 years with mass action and pressure, that a system, some sort of capitalistic system, could continue with progressive New Deal kind of reforms economically and politically, and also with mass action on climate change. I'm not so silly or naive that I'm going to say that the system that we live under can't adapt or reform, because it has in the past. Under the current trajectory, the system is doomed. Whether people want to recognize that or not, it's going to happen, at the very least ecologically. So where does that leave us? Well, it's a problem in terms of climate change, because only half of Americans recognize that global warming is man-made, or human-made, if you want to say. So how do you deal with a problem that people don't recognize exists? You can't deal with it until there's a stronger critical mass consciousness, and I think that's going to be one of the big challenges moving forward in the next 10 to 15 years, and now it is. What about economically? Well, 60% of Americans, if you look at some of the recent Pew and Gallup surveys, say that they have a positive view of capitalism, which is a majority, but it's not as big of a majority as I thought you might see in contemporary times, in light of people's commitment to this economic system over recent decades. To say 60%, that's interesting. 35% of Americans say they have a positive view of socialism. Now, we don't really know what that means in terms of this poll, these polls they ask, because these groups like Pew and Gallup, they just throw out these terms. What do you think about capitalism? What do you think about socialism? Well, people have a pretty good idea what capitalism is, but what socialism would be or could be, that's a whole different matter of discussion and fleshing out. What I think is interesting, though, is if you look at a recent Harvard poll, 2016, half of millennials said that they don't support and they don't like the idea of capitalism. And it's a significantly higher number than if you look at other age cohorts. And I think that the reason why this is happening is because people between 18 to, I guess you could say maybe 35, or 18 to 29, depending on how these pollsters measure the age categories, they've experienced a fundamentally different type of economy than someone would have in the 1940s, 1950s, and 60s and 70s, prior to the modern era of rising inequality and worker insecurity. So whereas people who are in older age groups are much less likely to say they like the idea of socialism or that they dislike capitalism, we have a fundamental disconnect culturally in the United States with millennials because they have had to deal with this modern dysfunctional economy and system more than anyone else in terms of record student debts, record inequality, massive increases in healthcare costs way beyond inflation and beyond people's income earnings. So they have felt the failure of this system. And if there is an alternative that's going to develop to our system today that we have, this capitalist system, I think that that potential lies with younger Americans, the ones who have felt this disconnect. So I think we're really at a crossroads here. Where we go, who knows? That's going to depend on whether people are active or not. But there has been talk of an uprising, right? We've heard that. But it's sort of strange because apparently the uprising includes people as radical leftist as Noam Chomsky to as sort of center-right as Hillary Clinton. She decided she was part of the resistance too. So what is this resistance? What is it? I had sort of mixed feelings about it until fairly recently because, to be honest, until really the last month or two, I thought it was largely reactionary. And I don't know how you build a positive future based on simply reacting to someone like Donald Trump, as reprehensible as he may be and is. So really it was largely reactionary, so you can't really talk about a transformational society or politics or economics if you're purely reacting to society becoming more reactionary, right-wing, moving more in that direction. So this uprising is interesting and I think potentially exciting in some sense, but also there are a lot of limits to it too. So is it an uprising? Is it transformational? Potentially, maybe, depending on where it goes. I think it's just starting to get interesting. On the one hand, if you go back and you look at these protests, which I've been involved at every stage of these protests over the last 6 to 8 months, November, they were purely anti-Trump, purely. If you go look at protests that were going on across the country after he was elected, it was purely, we don't like Donald Trump, we're against sexism, racism, homophobia, and so on. Most of the protests that I was involved in and saw and read about, they didn't really talk a lot about militarism or rising inequality, so they were extremely limited in talking more about identity politics issues, and there's nothing wrong with talking about those issues, but without talking about inequality or militarism, it's limited. This continued through January. I'm happy to say I was at the late January inauguration protests in D.C. It was an encouraging moment in terms of what estimates said were maybe 500,000 to 750,000 people who showed up. It's definitely the biggest protest I've ever seen or been a part of in Washington, D.C. or anywhere else. I was encouraged to see that there were a very wide range of different types of activists involved, whether we're talking about racially, in terms of age, a very eclectic group of people. So there was potential there for this to become something positive and proactive and not just something reacting to Donald Trump. If we're talking about January through February and the protests of the travel ban, again, still largely reacting to what Donald Trump was doing, I think it's gotten interesting since then, or more interesting. By the time April came around, we started seeing these marches for science, and this was the first indication I really saw that there was something positive building here, where the protests that I was involved in and demonstrations, people said, we're not just against Donald Trump being anti-science, we're also in favor of prioritizing spending on things like education and healthcare. That was definitely a big message on the East Coast for the protests that I was at in demonstrations. So that's, well, finally, we're starting to see something, and it's relatively early in these protests, so that's good that we're seeing it earlier on. Really, this month has been the first time where I would say I'm really starting to see an even stronger build towards something really proactive. And I've seen this on the East Coast, and I live in the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania, so I've pretty much been spending my time between there and D.C., that area of the country, but largely the Lehigh Valley area in Pennsylvania, which includes Bethlehem and Allentown. And another of, you know, many people who have been hurt by deindustrialization, really. Loss of manufacturing jobs, radical rise in inequality. And it's really something impossible to miss if you've ever traveled through towns like Allentown or Bethlehem, how much they've been hurt by rising inequality and deindustrialization. And we're not seeing, I would say, a push toward this idea that suddenly these steel jobs are going to come back to the area, contrary to what Donald Trump said about my concern is Pittsburgh, not Paris. That's not what people are talking about in that area. What they are talking about are things like universal health care. So the protests that I've been involved in demonstrations in July, it was very energizing and optimistic for me in the sense that not only were people talking about, well, we don't want the Affordable Care Act repealed. I mean, that's certainly something. There were things about that law, as critical as I've been of it, that were very important. Expanding Medicaid, particularly, getting rid of this ability to deny people care based on pre-existing conditions. Those were really hugely important things, that if this bill did nothing else, the Affordable Care Act, I think it would have been worth it to do those things. Is it a solution to American healthcare problems? Obviously not, I think. But what was interesting in these protests and in these gatherings is that there was a recognition on the part of activists that we're not fighting a reactionary battle here to preserve the Affordable Care Act. It was recognized that that was a concession that Democrats made to Republicans for some sort of market-based health care. But the idea here is health care is a human right. That was the theme. That's been the theme. And not just health care as a human right in some abstract sense, but health care as a human right in terms of universal health care. That's where we need to go. That's where the fight is going. That we want to build up community support across the country for nonprofit-based universal health care in which everyone has access to it as a right. Now, is that going to happen everywhere? I don't know. I'm observing protests in one part of the country, but that's where, obviously, I think we need to go. We're talking about a real resistance to the rightward movement of the United States and the rise of record inequality. So in that sense, there's some really encouraging things going on. We'll see where they go. What is stopping quicker change? Because I think that most people would probably agree, if we're talking about rising inequality and the rise of the Trump administration, that we have been moving in the wrong direction for some time now, for decades, especially in recent years with the rise of Donald Trump. So why is it, why is it that we haven't seen more positive change? And that's what I was thinking about in terms of preparing for this presentation. I wanted to talk about some things that I think get to the root of what the problem is. If we can address these issues, then there's going to be a better potential to move forward in terms of a real progressive transformation. One is that people just need to put in more effort in terms of questioning political leaders. While technically we live in an era where people say they're hugely distrustful of government, a lot of that is skin deep and superficial. I hear people endlessly talking about how they can't trust government and they're all crooks. Recently in the case of Illinois, I've heard numerous family members talk about how, well, Bruce Rauner might be a crook, but they're all crooks. And my response is, have you paid attention to what's happened in the last few years? Illinois in danger of being degraded in terms of its debt to junk bond status. institutions, higher learning particularly, and all those types of nonprofit civil society organizations providing hugely important social services, whether it's drug treatments or childcare, all types of other benefits people rely on. These services being eviscerated for the lack of a budget. I used to live in Illinois, in Springfield, Illinois, and I would sit through regularly House and Senate committee meetings where these groups would come in front of the House and Senate and plead and beg for revenues, and warning that they're going to have to shut their doors. And a number of these organizations have already shut down. And when we're talking about higher education, many colleges and universities in the state that have been reliant on state funding are on the brink of either shutting down, particularly Chicago State, or laying off large numbers of faculty, which has happened across the board, or losing even their accreditation, which has become a big concern for a lot of these universities. The point I'm making here is that things can always be worse. They've gotten even worse under the Rauner administration, as hard as that is to believe, with patronage politics in Illinois. And I'm talking to these family members, you know, they've got this sort of very general, vague sense of, well, things have always been bad and they're all crooks. It's like, well, there are levels of corruption and crookedness, and we got to pay attention to these things. Otherwise, these things happen, and then it's too late. You have this scorched earth policy where, if you're talking about higher education particularly, the Democrats in Illinois and legislatures throughout this country have been pursuing a sort of death of a thousand cuts approach to education for decades now, with the decline of tenure and the decline of funding and the rise in tuition costs. And Rauner has a sort of hatchet to the skull approach, which is kill the whole thing in a year or two if you can. So the point is that people need to pay more attention. And a lot of the problem that I think that comes up is that oftentimes if you're not paying close attention, it's very easy for people to get propagandized and manipulated. You have a lot of Americans who consider themselves supporters of the Democratic Party, who during the Obama years fell victim to a lot of his and the party's rhetoric about helping Americans. And what really happened during that era was that we saw a massive increase in inequality. That's a fact, that in the last 10 years we saw the rise of the alternative jobs economy and the rise of mass inequality and the further growing of costs for things like higher education and health care, despite the Affordable Care Act, which was a band-aid on a larger problem of a for-profit health care system. This administration, the Obama administration, promised to fix the problem of American jobs with rising unemployment. We really haven't seen that with the rise of the alternative work arrangements. That has not happened. He promised to fix the health care problem with an Affordable Care Act, which has provided neither affordable care or even care for still tens of millions of Americans, like a universal health care system would. The costs continue to go up approximately 10% a year, even accounting for inflation, even with this law, which did nothing to regulate health care premiums and costs, as it could have, at the very least. Anti-war rhetoric, which people bought and ate up hook, line, and sinker during the 2008 election. This president, President Obama, spent more on the military and on foreign wars than George Bush did. In his first 4 years in office, Obama spent more than Bush did in the first 4 years after 9/11. You think about that for a minute. He won a Nobel Peace Prize based on the premise that he was going to stop these silly wars in the Middle East. And then he continued to fight these wars and expanded them. And he expanded programs like drone strikes, targeted assassination, which were illegal under international law and still are. So there was a lot of good rhetoric coming out of the Obama administration. There were some things the Obama administration did to help the United States, whether we're talking about a stimulus that prevented an even further economic decline that would have happened with, in light of the 2008 economic crash. There were some things that were done that were a help in terms of this health care law, but really nowhere near enough to deal with the problem of rising inequality. And if you look at the approval rating for this administration going out of office, Obama left office with an almost 60% approval rating, because people looked at the incoming administration and said, my God, he looks like a saint compared to this guy. Well, maybe he certainly looks a lot less terrible than Donald Trump, but this is a continuation of something that's been going on for 30 to 40 years, rising inequality, worker insecurity, radically growing healthcare and education costs. This is the newest face on it, which is a much more brazen and blatantly raw face if we're talking about Donald Trump. But it is a continuation and an intensification of something that's already been happening. Well, Hillary Clinton was a lot less gifted rhetorically than Barack Obama in terms of charisma and ability to communicate with people. So that, I think, stripped away a lot of the support that she really came into this election a lot weaker than Obama left. In comparison to who she was running against, she should have mopped the floor with him if she had run a moderately competent progressive campaign, which she really didn't. You know, it really wasn't until she needed the Bernie Sanders votes post-primaries that she really even started talking about things like raising the minimum wage and free college education. And I think by that point, a lot of people weren't very convinced, or it certainly didn't blast a lot of people out of bed on election day. Nonetheless, you still have this problem where smooth-talking individuals in the Democratic Party have been able to convince Americans for a long time that if you just vote Democratic, things will be okay, and that has not been the case in recent decades with the rise of inequality between the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. Now, by the way, a lot of people like to pick on Americans with regard to this point, but it's not just an American thing. Obama was very skilled in his use of rhetoric to the point where almost the entire world bought the rhetoric. If you look closely at the public opinion polls, if you look very closely at them, when President Bush left office and Obama came in office, the BBC did a multinational survey across the world, different regions and countries, and they asked whether people had confidence in the United States to do the right thing in world affairs. And most countries throughout the world said they did not have confidence in the United States and the Bush administration when he left office. Enter the Obama administration and all of his rhetoric about democracy, and human rights and development, and that we were going to get out of these dumb wars like in Iraq. And I'll give it to the Obama administration, to this president. He was very active traveling the United States and the world, trying to cultivate a much more positive image of the United States. Now, as we've already talked about, the policy didn't really change. Still had drone strikes, assassinations, illegal wars on multiple fronts. It's just that the rhetoric was much nicer. And he gave lip service to these principles of human rights and democracy and development. It worked like a charm. If you look at the actual BBC polls, most countries that were surveyed, most people said that all of a sudden they had faith in the United States to do the right thing in world affairs. In 2015, the Pew Research Center, based out of Princeton, did a multinational survey. And they found that there was a majority approval of the United States, and it had a very positive image throughout most all countries surveyed in Asia, Africa, Latin America, Europe. There's only one region where they didn't have a majority support across countries surveyed, and I think you can guess which one I left off the list. It's not that hard to figure out. We're talking about the Middle East, the people who had actually experienced the wars the United States was fighting, whether it be in Syria or Libya or continued in Iraq, and so on and so forth. So it took the people who actually had to feel the effects of the militarism. They were the only ones who were able to cut through the crap in terms of the rhetoric. The rest of the world bought into this rhetoric, too. If you go back and look at President Obama's speeches, and I've done this pretty closely, there was never this talk of things like oil interests or power, maximizing power. You would see that kind of rhetoric going back to the George H.W. Bush administration and even the Carter administration before it, the Clinton administration, and in particular in their national security strategies of these different presidents and in their speeches. And through the second Bush administration as well. This was one thing that was very different with the Obama administration rhetorically, that he went out of his way to not use that kind of power politics rhetoric in terms of articulating national security strategies. And it worked. A lot of people thought that the United States was engaged in a much more positive role in the world because of this rhetoric. And it's interesting, and you go from Obama to Trump, and the approval ratings just sort of fall off a cliff. Now that the rhetoric has been stripped away, and this administration has made no bones about not caring about the Paris Climate Accord, or things like the international community, and so on and so forth, you look at the approval rating of the United States from Obama to Trump. At the end of Obama, according to the Pew Research Center, they surveyed 37 different nations right at the end of his administration, an average of 64% approval across these countries that they surveyed for the United States when Obama was leaving office. Well, that's not that different than the domestic rating, right, which was about 60%. So that falls right in the ballpark. Trump came into office right at the beginning of Trump. Now, he's gone further since then. So my guess would be if the numbers were resurveyed, they'd be less than this now and significantly less with him spitting in the face of the Paris Climate Accord. But right when he came into office, 49% approval. Went from 64 to 49 overnight. This is the problem when we talk about the issue of propaganda and rhetoric, that unless people are paying close attention, they don't recognize the way in which they're being manipulated through the use of language. So that's one of the big challenges, that people are just going to need to pay more attention to what's been happening if they want to conceptualize an alternative future. Another big problem I can speak firsthand about, because I've spent 2 decades in higher education, is the decline of public education in the United States. I think this finally came full circle with the election of Donald Trump. It finally became impossible to deny that there were going to be real, tangible consequences for the dumbing down of education. The fact that you can have a president who so blatantly and regularly thumbs his nose at facts and evidence-based reasoning, and so shamelessly, and can get elected, really speaks volumes about the decline of intellectual culture in a country like the United States. Now, this has been something going on for a long time. These things don't happen overnight. But from my vantage point in higher education, it was very obvious that we were building to this for a long time. We've had the quasi-privatization of higher education institutions with the dramatic cut in state tuition or tuition funding, which has basically been outsourced to students and parents, who now have to borrow massive amounts of money to pay for these degrees, which were almost virtually free 30, 40 years ago. Decline in tenure means it's become much harder for professors to take risks and become more critical in the classroom and challenge received truths or conventional wisdom or alleged conventional wisdom, because they have to worry about keeping their job and angering students who are increasingly seen as consumers rather than people who were there to learn and become citizens and intellectuals. And you can do both, by the way. That's a radical idea these days, that you could learn things in higher education and build vocational skills. But that's not what we've been seeing in recent years. We've been seeing the rise of this idea that education means earning, and it's about vocation, and you don't need things like a political science or government class or a history class, and people just need to know how to stick somebody with a needle when they come into the doctor's office. And that is the death of intellectualism, when education becomes nothing more than training. And that's what has happened in the last 20 years. With the rise of professionalization, and this has been something very much driven by an administrative corporate class in higher education, people who have come to power in the last 2 or 3 decades, who are not faculty, which used to be where a lot of administration was drawn from, faculty who would serve part-time in administrative positions. Well, we have seen a move away from that toward professional administrators who are taught in this modern era to run schools like businesses. And they've got this idea, again, that learning means earning, and they've pushed the idea of professionalization. This is something that was far less powerful 20, 30, 40 years ago and is much more powerful today. What do I mean by professionalization? There's an idea that has taken hold, and I can tell you this for a fact, although I've only been in higher education as an adult for 20 years, the historical memory goes back probably, I guess you would say, another 20 on top of that, with the people in my departments that I've worked alongside who remember the early 1980s and late 1970s. This idea that you're not there to change the world, you're not there to educate people, to challenge the system and the political economic status quo and think critically. You're there to publish things in academic journals and hopefully keep your head down and avoid all the bad pressure and bad press that comes from places like Fox News and elsewhere if you do speak out. And your job is not to reach the public with your research and be a public intellectual. Your job is to produce articles that maybe will get cited by one person and read by one person in each department across the country in your political science field, if you're lucky. And that's really sort of the death of higher education, and we've seen that in modern times. I gave an example of this anecdotally. I was at a conference recently in Chicago in April. It's one of the major flagship conferences in political science. And in the last couple of years, they have been actively patrolling the halls of the Palmer House, making sure that everybody has a badge. Why does everybody need a badge? Well, if you didn't pay to get in, then get the hell out. God forbid there would be this idea that it could be open to people in the public who might actually have something to learn from intellectuals. We don't want that. We're there to make money and for people to get conference presentations, to go on a resume, to get somebody a job or get them tenure. So when you look at professionalization through that lens, it doesn't look quite as good as the name sounds. It's a radically different system than what existed 20, 30, 40 years ago, where people previously could have maybe gotten tenure just based on teaching alone and just making a difference in the classroom. And by being a public intellectual, that was something that was actually valued. Now, I don't want to talk badly about the institution I'm currently affiliated with, because they're one of the few that I've found that actually does value people being public intellectuals and encourages that. But increasingly, we're seeing a move away from that. And that is where we have a really big problem in the United States intellectually, because who fills the vacuum if intellectuals and scholars don't speak up? Who fills the vacuum? Donald Trump fills the vacuum. Fox News fills the vacuum. People who are anti-intellectual fill the vacuum. We've seen a recent survey of Americans where something like half of Republicans now say, college, bad. Think about that for a minute. College is bad. It's quite a nuanced analysis. No, well, not really. But we all know there are problems with higher education that need to be dealt with, but that sort of simplistic, knee-jerk, tear it all down and burn it up mentality will make things worse than it is even now. So what's going on here in terms of this propaganda system? Well, it's been very effective, whether we're talking about media propaganda and a failure to challenge the current political economic status quo, and this is something that's been well known among political communication scholars, that journalists do not historically do a very good job of challenging government rhetoric and government officials and propaganda. Whether we're talking about the media or government propaganda itself or the failure of schools to educate people critically, it's led to a lot of Americans accepting utter falsehoods. Until they recognize that these things are falsehoods, I don't know that we can move forward to where we need to go. 60% of Americans in 2015 said, it's still possible in America if you work hard to get ahead. 54% said that same year that the U.S. is not divided between haves and have-nots. Half of America has zero financial assets. Half. And there's still this idea that there aren't have-nots. And half of the country has zero financial wealth in the wealthiest country in the world, where wealth and being a have is defined primarily through tangible financial assets. Half of people don't have any. And we still think, majority of Americans, that there is no such thing as a divide between people who have and people who don't. And this idea of working hard to get ahead, by the way, this may have been true in the 1940s and 50s and 60s and 70s, where people saw increased incomes on average, where the minimum wage was going up because of government action, where people were part of unions and that pressured for higher wages, and people who worked harder did get ahead and made more money. That's not been the case for 40 years. We know this very clearly by looking at the statistics. Families have worked, really since the 1970s, the number of work hours has gone up by a third. Male incomes have gone down by a third. As a result, we've had stagnating family and household incomes. People are working harder for the same amount of money. This idea that you have this Horatio Alger story where people go from rags to riches is nonsense. 60% of Americans still believe that if you work hard, you will get ahead. People have been working harder for 40 years now, and they're falling behind. People have become more unhealthy in America in terms of the obesity epidemic. Healthcare costs approximately double every decade, and incomes are not doubling. I know you all know that. They're not doubling, and healthcare costs do. The cost of higher education has gone up 100% in the last 20 years, too. Household debt. As a percentage of household income was 68% in 1980, as of 2011, 112%. The most common cause of bankruptcy today is healthcare costs. Big surprise. And the people who declare bankruptcy, most of them had healthcare. It wasn't very good healthcare. This is what a broken system looks like. Now, if you're working harder as a family and more hours, and you're more unhealthy than you used to be, and you're more in debt than you used to be, whether it's household debt in terms of education or credit cards or healthcare costs or whatever. You're working harder than you used to, you're more unhealthy, and you're more in debt than you've ever been, and cost of living has gone up more than anything you've seen in terms of your pay. You've fallen behind, clearly. That's a squeezing of the middle class. And most Americans have not been able to recognize that yet. And until they do, it's not going to be addressed. Until that happens. I think that's something important to point out. In terms of propaganda, one big problem is not just people being suckered into accepting this political rhetoric, because there are a lot of people who vote who do buy into this propaganda from the Democratic Party that they're going to make things better, despite things getting worse. There's a whole other group of Americans who have become, I guess for lack of a better term, I'd say diverted and alienated. They don't pay attention to what's going on in politics at all. They don't vote. This is roughly half of America. They're not voting. They're not paying attention to the news. They don't know what's going on. They've completely, divorced themselves from the political process. We're not going to make a lot of progress in terms of building some sort of progressive change until many of these people are shaken out of their apathy. Much of this diversion comes from the rise of cable news, to be honest, and cable in general. This has been something political scientists have documented. With the rise of cable, you've seen the massive proliferation of huge numbers of choices in terms of entertainment, where people have gravitated away from the news because they can. People who wouldn't have followed the news in previous generations had to because there weren't many media choices, but now we live in the era of a million choices and people aren't paying attention. Also, one interesting thing that's been shown, consumerism. Consumerism has been used as a sort of aphrodisiac for people to tune out. Because the cost of electronics and goods has gone down so much in the last 10 years, this has served as a way of pacifying people and created a sort of false consciousness where people think, well, maybe there isn't such a thing as have-nots. Everybody has a cell phone, don't they? Anybody can get a television. The cost of TVs has gone down dramatically in the last 10 years. Cell phones, too. Toys for children. So we've gotten to the point where people can benefit from these electronics and these goods, which are very entertaining, right? You can buy dozens of used DVDs for 50 cents or a dollar each, and you can live on your pile of sh** and not have health care and not be able to afford to send your kids to college, and if you do, be indebted permanently for it or cash in your 401k or your pension or whatever it is. And that's one of the issues, this idea of false consciousness. We need to get beyond this idea that we have it good and people have it good just because they have electronics. I've seen this a lot with students in the interviews I've done as I've pursued a project I'm working on with regards to inequality in America and why people don't recognize that there is a divide in this country. Why not? Many people I interview, countless people say, well, because I have all these modern conveniences that people didn't have 50 years ago. I have the cell phone, the computer, the television. And in that sense, people's lives have gotten easier, but what good are those things if you don't have health care or education? What good are they outside of being a diversion? So this is one of the issues that we have to deal with, being flooded with cheap goods. There's also a well-known correlation, or well-established, at least. I don't know if it's well-known among people who are big on consumerism. That consumerism is inversely linked to political engagement. That the more committed you are to consuming things, the less likely you are to pay attention to politics and vote. That's not to say people shouldn't be consuming things because you have to consume things to live, whether it's have clothing on your back or eat or whatnot or whatever. But the more people care about those things, the more that they become demobilized from politics. And that's what we've been seeing when we talk about alienation. There's this idea that there was a Trump uprising. If there was a Trump uprising in this last election, it was a very anemic one. There were these terms thrown around like populist, white working class rebellion, uprising. I don't want to say there wasn't some kind of uprising, but really it was more of a demobilization than anything else. What we have seen, if you look closely at the exit polls and the voting data, is that the Democratic Party lost 3.5 times more working class Rust Belt voters than the Republican Party under Trump gained when you compare the 2012 presidential election to 2016. So what happened was the same old Republican base turned out in 2016 as they did in 2012, but what propelled him into office was the demobilization of the other side. And this is what the Democratic Party has fundamentally failed to recognize when you hear them constantly obsessing over Vladimir Putin did it. Well, certainly there are concerns about the Trump administration and their wheeling and dealing, and this whole art of the deal, let's do horse trading of policy outcomes for financial benefits, which I've documented in my writings in a dozen different ways this happens. This kind of cronyism certainly is a concern. But If the idea is that the Democratic Party lost in this election purely because of Vladimir Putin, that's an absurdity that has never been documented in terms of actual voting and why people voted. So I think we have to be careful about that too. One last thing I would point out. We've seen a real failure of the left in the United States, or what's called the left, what's left of the left, which plays into this in terms of obstacles for change. We've seen a decline in critical thinking in higher education that I've already talked about. There were these people who used to be left public intellectuals in the 1960s coming out of the Vietnam era through the 1970s and 80s, and most of that's gone now. And that is a problem. We have to take back higher educational institutions if we want there to be real change. The decline of unions has been another big part of this. So many Americans today are afraid of speaking up in the workplace because they don't have basic worker protections through a union contract, and they have employment at will. Their employers will, by the way, not theirs if they get fired. They didn't decide that. So these are things that we need to address. What's called the left today in the United States, we've got a lot of public intellectuals who write a lot of things for different venues and mediums, and that's certainly great. But one thing I've noticed in recent years is that we've become profoundly good at being against things. A lot of progressive and left intellectuals, and we haven't spent much time sort of talking about what we're for and what we want to build. People are great at criticizing the Democratic Party, which I've spent plenty of time on, and the Republican Party and the system, but they haven't taken the time to talk about and develop where we need to go. It's gotten to the point where when we talk about public intellectualism, I learned very little from left online and left print media today. It's not that there aren't smart people working in it, but we need to move beyond the criticism. And that's part of what this presentation has been about, trying to flesh out where we're going with these anti-Trump protests and how we could build something more productive than just opposing a single president, because if that's what it is, then the air gets sucked out of the room once he's gone. So we're really not left with anything outside of that. Now, I will say in terms of a positive, to conclude all this, Karl Marx had an interesting quote. He said, men make their own history. We should say people today, properly sensitive to gender equality. Men make their own history, people make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances. I don't think it's an accident that we've seen the first real mass wave of protest in the last 10 years in an era of record inequality. Really the biggest protests and wave upon wave of protests, whether we're talking about Black Lives Matter or the Fight for 15 or the Madison anti-Scott Walker protests or Occupy Wall Street or now the healthcare protests, the anti-Trump protests. I don't think it's an accident that all of these things are happening one after another at this era of crisis in terms of healthcare costs, education costs, declining incomes, record inequality. I think what's going to happen when we talk about this quote from Karl Marx is that as people become more and more economically insecure and as we move more and more towards environmental crisis, there's just going to be more and more pressure for people to act. Will that action come quickly enough to deal with some of these problems? I don't know. Anyone who tells you they have an answer is lying. I hope that we can act sooner than later, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Can you comment on the amount of the national treasure that has been devoted to the development of the nuclear project, both weapons and medicine and the production of electricity?
Well, I spent a lot of time as an undergraduate as an anti-nuclear activist in central Illinois, because Illinois, as people probably know, has more nuclear power plants than just about anywhere else. I guess if we're talking about cost, we shouldn't kid ourselves that this was a massive cost sustained really by taxpayers to develop the whole viability, to the extent that it is viable, nuclear energy going back to the 1940s and 50s. I think you're probably talking about somewhere along the order of hundreds of billions of dollars from the numbers I remember reading years ago, in terms of not just developing the nuclear technology, which the government had to have a hand in, but insuring these companies that were then going to take the reins, because no private insurer was going to pay for the danger of something like a nuclear power plant. They just wouldn't do it. It was an entirely unnecessary technology. It was a complete waste and dangerous, in the sense that now we are stuck with radioactive waste for thousands or even tens of thousands of years or possibly even longer. We talk about radioactive decay and isotopes and how dangerous these things are, not to mention the environmental dangers. I mean, we're talking about even places like Braidwood, which is not that far from Chicago, where they've had problems with tritium leaking into the groundwater, so there's not only a financial drain but an ecological cost. And that's not even to talk about the danger of nuclear weapons, right, and the amount of money spent capitalizing, developing, and reconstituting those, which we do every generation. I think you're talking on the order of hundreds of billions of dollars, if not even trillions in the long term in terms of storage of the nuclear waste and the other kind of damage that could come along with that along the way. Fortunately, if there is a fortunately in that, it seems to be a technology on life support, or essentially dead at this point, since Three Mile Island, we haven't seen the building of nuclear power plants, new ones. I was on the front lines of fighting this in central Illinois and Bloomington Normal because there was talk at the Exelon plant in Clinton about adding another nuclear reactor, and that would have been the first one added in decades. It did not happen, fortunately, because this technology has become so unviable in terms of competing with alternative energy sources, whether they be renewable or not. So I think we're sort of beyond the hump right now in terms of this danger of creating more nuclear power, but we've still got to deal with the after effect of it in terms of nuclear energy. And then, of course, there's always the specter of nuclear war as well, which has been a problem under both political parties in terms of belligerence towards China and Russia. And that's something that can only be limited through people being more vigilant in terms of activists. So hopefully that deals with the questions you have a little bit. I think I'm on your side when we talk about the danger. That's the challenge moving forward. If nuclear energy is not making a comeback, then we're talking about nuclear weapons and the cost. And I would go beyond just nuclear weapons. The entire idea of spending hundreds of billions of dollars on the military every year has directly come at the cost of education and healthcare. It's been very parasitic. It's benefited some people in terms of military contractors. It's been very harmful for the average American in terms of monetary priorities and infrastructure and development and health.
This is KPFT 90.1 Pacifica Radio in Houston. And we've been listening to a talk by Anthony DiMaggio, and it's titled, Does Capitalism Have a Future? And his latest article is Higher Education Fallacies, What's Behind the Rise of Conservative Distrust of Learning? And this audio comes to us from Open University of the Left, and was recorded on July 21st. All right, well, we're going to wrap things up. I want to thank everybody who contributed to tonight's show. Lillian Kerr, my co-host, and her segment, A Bird's Eye View. Larry Kurzan with the news. Mary Hanks does our calendar events. And on the board tonight, we've got Nick Allen. And helping him, we got Glenn McClatchy. I'm Wally James. Thanks so much for being there, folks. And coming up next, we have Jacqueline Batiste with People of Earth. And following her, it's Scooter with the Inner Side. So stick around, and we will see you next week. Have a great weekend.
KPFT Houston thanks our community partners. AIDS Foundation Houston, offering free HIV testing every Monday and Tuesday. More information at AIDSHelp.org. Food Music Life Food Truck, serving weekly at Urban Harvest Farmers Market and the Museum of Fine Arts. More information at foodmusiclife.org. And ongoing concerts like Tommy Emmanuel, performing at Cullen Music Hall on December 15th. Tickets and more information are available at Ticketmaster.com.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is July 27th. On this day in 1880, African-American inventor Alexander Ashbourne received a patent for developing a refinement process for coconut oil. This process included filtration, bleaching, heating, and treatment with hydrogen to remove unsaturated fatty acids. Ashbourne's method was revolutionary due to the lack of technological advancement at the time. Food companies worldwide still use his refinement process today.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365, BAM 365, where you find every day Black History is made.
I'm crying looking for you.